Coming up on Golf Today, Victor Hovland turns Olympia Fields into his personal playground. A back 9, 28, a course record 61, and triumph at the BMW. We take you inside his historic round. And the U.S. Ryder Cup team is halfway there after six players qualified yesterday. But who should make up the final six? And what about Brooks? Take him or leave him? Plus, an interview with sports gambler Billy Walters on his stint in prison, Las Vegas betting, and his former relationship with Phil Mickelson, giving you millions of reasons to watch on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Golf Today on a Monday. Damon Hack alongside George Savarikas. A theme has developed in these playoffs, in my opinion. Great ball striking, Lucas Glover, Victor Hovland, great putting as well, and great drama all the way up to the final putt.
I mean, it started the beginning of the regular season with the drama we saw at the Florida Championship, produced all the way through the Wyndham, and now the first two legs of the FedEx Cup playoffs have gone right down to the wire, especially the final nine to finally see who's going to emerge and win. And what Victor Hovland did, those final nine holes, that's just not supposed to happen on the North Course at Olympia.
We're told this is a U.S. Open venue.
Yeah, it has been.
28, come again?
Well, and remember in 2020 when John Rahm won it,
we're
under.
Yeah.
Got you in a playoff. Victor
different
Hovland
story.
Was 7-under his final nine holes. Different conditions, but an amazing performance. And now we're starting to see Victor Hovland get ready to take that next step.
This was really cool to be able to win at this golf course without I had a quick glance at my stats, and I guess I lost a little bit around the green, and to win by doing that at this golf course is that means that you've hit the ball really well and putted it really well, and that's what I've done this week. At Memorial, I think Jack's course is one of those courses where it's just set up to not beat it, if that makes sense. You can play really well and easily miss half of the fairways and miss half of the greens. It's just one of those that's just really tough, whereas Olympia Fields, I think, is a lot more straightforward, if you will. It's still really, really hard, but I hit the ball really straight, so I hit a lot of fairways and I hit a lot of greens, and my putter just caught on fire the last couple of days, and here we are.
So you are heading into Eastlake as the second youngest person in the field and only 3 years older than the youngest FedEx Cup winner ever. Going back to maybe like your 2018 U.S. amateur win, did you imagine your career taking off as quickly as it did? Like, where are you now compared to where you thought you would be at this age?
I could only dream about winning these tournaments back in 2018. That was basically, I think I'd won one college event before winning the U.S. Amateur, and then winning the U.S. Amateur, that kind of changed a lot of things, and got to play in a couple of majors as an amateur, and still had to get my card, and then I got my PGA Tour card, and then a couple months later, I won my first tour event, and just kind of continuously, I've checked off the boxes, but it's not like I'm expecting to win X amount of tournaments or to win X amount of majors. It's just, okay, this is as good as I am right now. What could I do to get better? And if I get better, I have the chance of winning these events. And whatever happens, happens. And it's been pretty cool to win two events this year at two golf courses that are very difficult. And I've had to rely on all of my skill sets, not just a couple of things.
Did some special final rounds by winners this season on the PGA Tour. Jason Day at the Nelson, Sepp Straka at the Deere, John Rahm with that 63 on Maui. But none better, maybe the round of the year, Victor Hovland, 61 in Olympia Fields to win in the playoffs, George.
It was impressive stuff from Victor Hovland. And on Tuesday, I was at Olympia Fields, part of the Comcast Business Tour Top 10. Had a conversation. It was Victor Hovland, John Rahm, Keegan Bradley, Wyndham Clark. And just talking about the season, looking ahead to the Ryder Cup. And it was fascinating in talking with John Rahm, who now has 11 PGA Tour wins, two majors. He won the 2020 BMW Championship at Olympia Fields. And I was chatting with him about how analysts and analytics had put all these expectations on him ascending to the heights where he's at now, with four wins a major, the likely PGA Tour Player of the Year. And he said, I felt that inside. I thought I was capable of getting to that point. When I spun it to Victor Hovland, he's not necessarily a guy who wants to say, this is what I can do next. And I thought this soundbite, the beginning of the year, talking with the DP World Tour on how he goal sets, kind of gave you an opportunity to peek under the hood into the psyche of Victor Hovland.
With your eyes on 2023, what are your main goals and objectives be for next year, do you think?
I don't really like to set a lot of specific goals that are results-oriented. I just kind of try to improve my game every single day, and I like to structure my everyday life, you know, make minor tweaks here and there that in the long term are gonna make big differences. You know, I think a lot of people overestimate how much they can do in one day, but they underestimate how much they can do over time if they implement certain good routines. So yeah, I'm a big fan of just trying to optimize here and there a little bit every day.
Love what he said. A lot of people overestimate what they can do in a day, underestimate what they can do over time. So if you compare Jon Rahm and Victor Hovland, there are a ton of similarities. Jon Rahm is 3 years older than Victor Hovland. He got his fifth win on the PGA Tour at the BMW Championship at the age of 25. That was his first multi-win season. He had won the Memorial and the BMW Championship. Victor Hovland, 3 years younger, is at 25. His first multi-win season, now coming this season, he won the Memorial and the BMW Championship. So Victor's not one to say, I'm capable of winning multiple majors. My goal is to be world number one. I think we're now seeing him scratch the surface of greatness. He's ranked fifth in the world. He's been up to three. He's had these close calls in majors. I think he's going to be ready to make that next jump that Jon Rahm did from 25 to 28, where he then rattled off 6 wins, 2 majors, and has become a guy that we view in the same light as a Roy McIlroy, as a Brooks Koepka. Victor is close. He's getting there. And Sunday was the type of performance where we all know what he's capable of going forward.
It's been fun to watch the progression in the quality of wins in this player as well. His first win comes in Puerto Rico. Then he wins a couple of times in Mexico. Then he wins Jack's tournament. Now he wins in the playoffs. You mentioned contention in major championships. We're also seeing the remarkable ability to hit his irons close. This looked like a Scottie Scheffler, Matt Fitzpatrick, Rory McIlroy duel. And all of a sudden, Victor Hovland is just flagging it time and time again. His length of birdie putt yesterday on that back nine was something special. Let's take a look at some of the numbers here, folks. On the 10th hole, 3 feet, 11, 12 feet. The 12th hole, 4 feet, 8 inches. The 15th hole, he had an 8-footer. The 17th and 18th hole, those difficult par fours where guys are just hanging on. He hits it to 8 feet, 9 inches, and 6 feet, 7 inches. I texted Alan Brandt this morning, the Oklahoma State Cowboys coach, who told me that Victor also has the course record at Carson Creek, which is the school golf course. It's a 62 that he shot there, one of the most difficult golf courses in college golf. Incoming freshmen cry when they play that golf course because they've never played such a difficult course. And that was the story that Alan Bratton saw during Victor's college career. Continued progression. Has always been strong with his iron play, Alan told me, but his green reading has gotten better and better, and with that, more confidence on the greens. And we saw that in spades yesterday. That was a remarkable performance.
Victor has publicly talked about deficiencies in his game and areas that he's tried to improve on. And he said, even this week, he wasn't phenomenal in strokes gained around the greens, but he had a hot putter and the rest of his game was able to make up for it. And I think he's been able to identify what needs to be addressed longer term in the evolution of Victor Hovland. The ball striking tee to green is something that he will not only be able to hang his hat on for the early stage of his career, but that's a formula that should work for 5, 10, 20 years. That's why he's not afraid of Carson Creek.
Yeah,
the guy hits it on a string. I mean, all you see is fairway. You don't see any trouble when you're Victor Hovland. When you have that type of game off the tee, and then when you're holding an iron to be that dialed, golf's got to be fun.
It is, and I tell you what, we're going to be talking about the Ryder Cup a lot on this Monday. I couldn't help but think about how Victor Hovland is going to become one of the linchpins of the European Ryder Cup team. And we talk about all the shifting sands in professional golf and who won't be there for Team Europe, for example, Ian Poulter, Lee Westwood, kind of a changing of the guards. But all of a sudden, Victor Hovland is like the next man up. It's going to be Rory McIlroy and John Rahm, and Victor Hovland, you know, has a seat at that table along with Shane Lowry and some of the newer faces that we'll see for Team Europe.
There's a change in voices. And when I was talking with John on Tuesday, he said, even though I had a ranking that was top five in the world, I was a younger guy in 2018 and 2021. So I wasn't the one leading the team room for Team Europe. That's going to be totally different next month in Rome. It's going to be Rory and John Rahm as your two main horses leading that team. I would think Victor Hovland would also be slotted in. Victor, outwardly, very carefree, easygoing guy, but you know he's a cutthroat competitor.
Yeah.
And I think he will be a good balance with Rory and John as a third voice in Team Europe. But I think historically what's made Team Europe so effective as a, quote, underdog, yet over time they've had periods where they've dominated the Ryder Cup is their cohesion 1 through 12. And I think having those three at the top, you have six of the top 15 in the world are now Team Europe. It's a pretty good mix where on paper it doesn't seem as mismatched as maybe a year ago Americans were touting that.
Well, it was Victor Hovland's day outside of Chicago on Sunday, but for a lot of the day it looked like it would be Scotty Scheffler's turn, and it was remarkable seeing just how different these two players play. We talked about the great putting of Victor Hovland. This is Scotty Scheffler with chances down the stretch. The 16th hole, he hit a beautiful shot there and missed that putt. Now this on the 17th hole.
Yeah, this to avoid dropping a shot. Another lip out. I mean, he makes those two. He finished two back. He would have been at 17 under. We are nitpicking with Scotty Scheffler. He did shoot a final round 66, so not as though he played poorly, but there's one thing that stands out, and it's been the same storyline all season long in what's held him back on what otherwise has been, ball striking-wise, a Tiger-esque season, and that has been the putter in some of the biggest moments. Hasn't been the same type of putter that it was a year ago for Scotty Scheffler when he was top 60 on the PGA Tour. Why do you think that's been the case?
It's the putter. And now I think that even the broadcasters are saying the quiet part out loud. And I thought Scotty's done a great job since I don't care what anybody in the media thinks. I'm protecting my confidence is fine. But he is missing some crucial putts down the stretch. And we saw that yesterday on the back nine. Those strokes gained numbers. First, you know, in strokes gained tee to green. First in approach, and then you're 38th in putting. And these were the putts that he had chances on the back nine. Would it look like it would be his tournament? Would it look like it would be a year where he won Phoenix and won the Players and added a playoff event? We've been waiting for that third victory this season. I mean, look at these opportunities that he had. And what stunned me the most, you know, listening to the broadcast and watching yesterday, when he missed that par putt on the 17th hole, our buddy Trevor Uman said, pushed it. Like, right away, he said, pushed it. I feel like, out of respect, a lot of former players have kind of been tippy-toeing a little bit around Scotty Scheffler's putting. I mean, the numbers don't lie. We can show the strokes gained putting graphics all we want. But to hear Trevor so quickly say, oh, he pushed that putt of just about 6 feet in length, was telling to me that this is becoming a larger talking point in the game than maybe I even expected. Because the ball striking has been superb. The way, and I was at TPC Sawgrass for the Players' Championship and interviewed him after that round, and the incredible ball striking that he has displayed this season. It's just in remarkable contrast to the club that has let him down.
I think the reason that the narrative has gone so bearish with Scotty Scheffler is because of what he did a year ago, and the putter was top half of the PGA Tour.
Yeah.
But if you look at his career, look at the strokes gained putting since he first joined the PGA Tour. 117th, 107th, 58th. So he had one outlier year where he was pretty good. And then this year, 145th. His putter's been like Colin Morikawa over Morikawa's career. And Morikawa, we've just kind of accepted that that's the area he's deficient. If he putts average, it's a week that he could probably win. And that's why Colin has five wins and two majors. Scotty has not been a great putter. He had one year that he was above average to pretty good. And now he's regressed to a point that's the worst of his career, but more in line with what we saw his first two seasons on the PGA Tour.
Yeah.
Amazing ball striker. If he putts average, then watch out. I'm not sure going forward where we're going to see if Scotty's going to fall around 100, if that's where he is for his career, if he makes some tweaks in the offseason to figure out, okay, how do I even get this to 80th? and then I'd probably win PGA Tour Player of the Year and lead the tour in wins. I mean, what his tee to green numbers are just...
It's like Vijay Singh. It's Vijay Singh back in the day.
It's
he could ball strike his way and be decent in putting and win 5, 6, you know, 9 times as he did in 2004.
Yeah.
But right now, it's just the feeling is off. This season could have been a 6-7 win season if that putter had just had a little bit of warmth in it.
And I know we weigh everything on wins.
Yeah.
82. Everyone in golf knows that number.
Yeah.
18 majors, 15 for Tiger. Wins are so important. But I think if you look at Scottie Scheffler's season.
Great season.
From a high-level consistency standpoint.
Incredible.
The best on the PGA. Yeah,
absolutely.
16 top tens.
There every week. He's there every week.
And the number of players that he's beaten this season. He's only had 3 starts. He finished outside the top 12. So his entire body of work, amazing. But it's going to be Jon Rahm who ultimately will likely get PGA Tour Player of the Year because of the wins at the end of the day are how you weight a season. I don't necessarily think fairly so, but that's just – how it is when it comes to award season, Damon.
Well, Scottie Scheffler's going to have another opportunity this week at East Lake. Take a look at the starting strokes. You know, there he is again at minus 10. Had that great opportunity 1 year ago. Rory McIlroy able to make up a 6-shot deficit to win a 3rd FedEx Cup title. So now you see Scottie Scheffler with a 2-shot lead over Victor Hovland going into Thursday's opening round. All right, folks. The top 6 automatic qualifiers for the U.S. Ryder Cup team have been locked in. Who made it and who did not and what tough choices lie ahead for Captain Zach? My goodness, we discuss after the break.
The 6 automatic qualifiers for Team USA. 3 Ryder Cup rookies, Damon.
Yeah, I see a lot of quality here. And I think that you got Scottie Scheffler now number 1 in qualifying, number 1 in the FedEx Cup. Wyndham Clark, what a June he had at the Los Angeles Country Club. Brian Harmon, 58 for 59, inside 10 feet putting. Patrick Cantlay and Xander Schauffele, we've seen them pair together beautifully like a nice Merlot and a steak. And, of course, Max Homa undefeated at the President's Cup. I mean, that's a strong 6. I think Zach Johnson would be pleased.
I think he would be very pleased. It's also interesting to have 3 rookies of the 6 qualify. But then you float back a couple years ago, and Steve Stricker had 6 rookies out of his 12-man team. So there is precedent for having a lot of rookies and being successful. Very different if it's on American soil when you're going to Team Europe. But those guys have been playing well. A lot of them are obviously carrying that good form into this part of the year. So I think he'd be very pleased. I think 2 months ago, not exactly the 6 we would have thought to have been AQs. I mean, Brooks barely slides out to 7. You had Wyndham Clark and Brian Harmon, the last 2 major champs, make huge jumps.
Yes.
Wyndham, when I was chatting with him earlier this week, said in February, that was the last thing on his mind.
Yeah, right?
Was considering the Ryder Cup.
He's like, what?
And now
that?
He's an automatic qualifier. So I think the team has changed a lot at the top since the beginning of the summer.
Still a lot to be determined as well. Let's take a look at the timeline, what you want to pay attention to over the next couple of weeks. So as mentioned, 6 have qualified after the BMW. Now Zach Johnson has to make 6 captain's picks a week from Tuesday. That's August the 29th. And then European Ryder Cup qualification ends September the 3rd. 6 automatically qualify for Europe as well. Then Luke Donald will make his 6 captain's picks the next day, September 4th. And the Ryder Cup, of course, Marco Simone Golf and Country Club near Rome, September the 29th through October the 1st. So we thought it'd be kind of fun to kind of put our little stamp, our imprint on who we think should be Zach's picks at this point. And this was tough for me. I don't envy Zach. I've got Colin. Colin, listen, clinching point, Wisconsin went 3-0-1. Jordan Spieth, he's the golden child. I think he's almost always going to be there. Brooks Koepka, listen, he won what could be called the flagship event of the PGA of America, the PGA Championship. Played great at the Masters. What Ricky Fowler, what a comeback story. Sam Burns won the match play. I was there in Austin. Saw it with my own eyes. Great friends with Scottie Scheffler. And, of course, Lucas Glover, the story of the past month, in my opinion, in professional golf. My first out is Keegan Bradley. My second out is Justin Thomas. But those are my 6 at this point.
All right, let's take a look at my 6. Some similarities, some different. Had Brooks Koepka, Jordan Spieth. I mean, both with winning records, have been part of victorious Ryder Cup teams. Cameron Young, I know he's kind of hot or cold as far as people thinking he's going to be in the mix or not. I think at ninth, he's played his way on to the team. He said, I want to rate this year as a C-minus. It's probably a B. Just harken back a year ago to the eagle he made at St. Andrews on the 77th hole. He's a very chill guy. He can run hot with his own game. I think he'd thrive in a road environment if you pair him with the right guy. And with his putting and what he can do off the tee, I think it would be a good formula for sure. Colin Morikawa looked good in 2021. The last two, which I think it's like, you have 10 where you feel pretty good about it, and I don't envy Zach Johnson. This is only going to get harder after this week. I was then looking at, 2018 Ryder Cup. All we did was go on either like form or big name and didn't think, what are the guys that we would want to optimize our chances of winning in France with a narrow course, narrow fairways, rough up. And we just went with big name star power, and we got trounced there. So I think Keegan Bradley, a guy historically who's good off the tee, and then it was hard either thinking Ricky Fowler or Lucas Glover. Lucas Glover's played in two Presidents Cups, was 2-6, didn't have a great record, but that was 15 years ago. So I don't know how much stock you put in that. So Ricky was probably the last guy I'd consider. Bryson DeChambeau and Justin Thomas could also be in the conversation. Bryson, the last time it was on the road, was winless. And I think that's the big thing, is you're picking 12 players that give you the best chance of winning. You look at the U.S. captain's picks combined record in 2018 and 2014. 2018, for Jim Furyk, they went 2-10.
It was awful.
DeChambeau, Mickelson, Woods, all winless. Tony Finau at least went 2-1. 2014. Keegan Bradley, Hunter Mahan, Webb Simpson, 2-5-2, downright terrible. You combine those, they've gone 4-15-2. So who are the players that are best suited for that course, who also fit in the team room, who are also trending in the right direction? Those are the six who should be picked, because at the end of the day, all that matters, who gives you the best chance to win?
Well, on this point, 2018 and 2014 didn't have LIV Golf. Now we have LIV Golf as a part of this story. It's not just about the golf course setup. It's also about cohesion and chemistry. Brooks Koepka, we both have him on this team, even though he's not an automatic qualifier. What was the decision-making in your mind on why he should be a part of Zach Johnson's squad?
He has a winning record. He's played well this season. I think he's had a conciliatory stance when it comes to meshing with guys on the PGA Tour. I don't think he really cares that much, or the guys that he sees in Jupiter care that much. To me, if you think a guy can fit into the team room, who cares what tour he plays on? You're trying to win the Ryder Cup. At the end of the day, that's all that should matter. You're going to have us media types asking questions Tuesday and Wednesday. If the U.S. is up 9-7 on Saturday, do you think they're really going to be like, hey, Captain Johnson, what did you think of Brooks's prep at LIV Golf Bedminster? No, you're going to say, okay, well, how have the pairings worked with Brooks? What do you expect on Sunday Signals? Is he going to go out third, or is he going to be second to last? So if you think a guy's potentially a huge distraction, I don't think Brooks would be, then you have to weigh certain personality types, which I know Steve Stricker did in 2021. The tour thing doesn't really concern me. It's more, how does a guy mix in to a team room with 12 guys for that week? Yeah. Europe has taken very different personalities, guys who didn't necessarily love hanging with each other week in and week out on the European Tour, DP World Tour, PGA Tour. They make it work for that week. The U.S. team, that's the same thing they have to do. What was your thought process?
Yeah, Brooks has not been an antagonistic personality when it comes to this PGA Tour v. LIV, I guess, past, we'll call it. He has been honest about the issues that he had. Injury, loss of confidence were the reasons that he went. He didn't kick the door down, didn't burn the building down on the way out of it like some players have. I think had he had a different tack and a different tone, it would be a different decision. I think his quality of golf is too good. He's a five-time major champ. He's a Brahma bull. You're going on the road. You want to bring your best. This isn't a PGA Tour event. It's a PGA of America event as far as the United States is concerned. I think had he had a different tone and different tack and different voice on the way out the door, I might have a different choice. I think he's too good to leave at home.
And I know some people are going to say, how could you not pick Bryson DeChambeau.
He was that's a difference. I have no problem. Listen,
no, and
big hitter, major champ.
Correct. 58 at Greenbrier.
You're bringing the circus. So that's the thing. That's the thing that Zach Johnson has to weigh. Every great coach in sports has to weigh distractions. It's about minimizing distractions. I think at this point where we sit in 2023, if Bryson DeChambeau is on that plane, I think the entire media storm will be different. I think those press conferences will be different. I think Zach Johnson has to do everything he can to minimize distractions. I don't think Brooks Koepka is as much of a distraction as Bryson DeChambeau would be. And some of that's just personality. You know, Bryson DeChambeau is a wonderful golfer. And I think he's trying to mature and has shown some improvement
Bryson
in that.
Even though Bryson had the best moment of the 2021 Ryder Cup, driving the first hole,
I was there.
Eagle,
it was remarkable.
Had a winning record.
It was beautiful.
The reason I wouldn't pick Bryson, and I'm less concerned about the overall distraction volume, but I agree that he would be more so than Brooks would be.
Yeah.
If you're weighing the two apples to apples. His game was a terrible fit for that venue in 2018. Winless.
Yes.
He blasts it, bombs it off the tee. They're probably going to have the exact same formula. Europe.
Shrink the course.
That's not Bryson's
dog leg it up.
Necessarily.
Yeah.
So that's why I would have some trepidation where is his game plus the volume that would accompany it the best fit for that course to help Team USA win. I don't know, but he would be on that list of three or four guys just on the outside where it warrants Zach Johnson having a conversation with him if he picks him or doesn't pick him and just saying, here's why you were close, or here's why you're the last guy in.
Close, hope you root for us from afar. I don't envy Zach Johnson over the next couple of weeks. Very, very difficult. Absolutely.
All right, still more to come as we're just getting the ball rolling here on Golf Today. He's a past Payne Stewart Award recipient, and after the break, he's going to join the show. Never a dull moment with our pal Peter Jacobson. Stick around. You're going to see that next.
So great to have Jake join us on this Monday. You know, Gary Koch's our good friend and colleague as well. Jake, what makes him such an ideal fit for this award?
Gary, as you know, has always flown under the radar. He's all about commitment to the game, commitment to the community where he lives and the charities he supports, which is exactly what Payne represented. Gary might not have the flash and the outgoing personality that we see on television on a regular basis, but Gary was always the guy that was lending a helping hand. He was the rock for Tommy Roy on that broadcast team with NBC for so many years. Nobody knows more about golf than Gary Koch. In fact, Roger Maltby always joked Gary could tell you who won the Open Championship back in 1898, not only who he beat, but by how many shots. So Gary is, and what he's done in the Tampa area where he lives for his charity and the First Tee and the Gary Koch Pro-Am down there with Powered Design, it's truly impressive. And I'm just so proud that Gary is going to add this to his resume because he certainly deserves it.
Jake, what were the conversations like to help kind of push Gary to the forefront to have him be the recipient for the Payne Stewart Award this year?
Well, one of the great honors is that all the past recipients of the Payne Stewart Award, we get a vote. And we all talk amongst ourselves. We start a text chain about who we think is most deserving. And the PGA Tour does a great job. They give us a list of 6 or 8 or 10 names that we put in every year, and it just seems so natural for Gary. We've all played in his pro-am. We've all been interviewed by him. A lot of us have worked with him, and we thought, okay, now that Gary's retired from television and NBC, now is the time. He's been deserving for so many years, and we finally get to honor Gary at the Payne Stewart Award Tuesday night.
The first award was given out back in 2000. Jake, are you amazed at just what this has become, one of the most important nights on the PGA Tour calendar?
Well, in a way, Payne Stewart, as you know, was a figure bigger than life. Payne didn't play for money. Payne played for principle. He's such a family guy, such a community guy, such a guy rooted in charity that I think what the tour has done to be able to celebrate Gary, to celebrate Payne and what Payne means to the game of golf is fantastic. I've always said we've got a Hall of Fame, but the Payne Stewart Award recognizes not only what you do inside the ropes, but also outside the ropes. So it makes me feel good to know that our pal Payne Stewart and my bandmate from Jake Trout and the Flounders, we lost him way too early. And it was just the saddest occurrence in the game of golf. But now when we look back on it and we get to honor people like Gary Koch and all the Payne Stewart Award winners that represent every aspect of Payne's character, it's going to be a feel-good evening, and it is a wonderful tribute to a great guy.
You spent a lot of time with Gary inside and outside the ropes, especially as part of the traveling circus that is the NBC Sports golf broadcast, going around the world for that. Do you have a favorite memory or story that would best kind of signify the time that you guys spent together as part of that broadcast team?
Well, when you look at our team, and we had Johnny Miller and we had David Faraday and Roger Maltby, and we had a lot of people that could jump out front. Dan Hicks. We had people that could grab the mic and just take over the evening. Gary Koch could do that as well. However, Gary Koch was always behind the scenes at the same time, helping everybody get better. I know that when I joined Tommy Roy's team with NBC, and they put me in an outer tower, and now that is a certain challenge in itself. You're part host and you're part analyst. Gary helped me. He showed me what to do, how to do it. He's always working with the people that walk on the golf course, because that's where Gary started, as an on-course reporter. But I think more than anything, Gary, he was the rock of that team. Again, Dan Hicks was the voice. Johnny Miller sat in the analyst chair. Roger was so great on the ground. But I think if you ask every one of those guys, they would say that Gary Koch was the straw that mixed that drink and made everybody pay attention. He's just so well-deserving and such a wonderful guy.
As we honor Gary tomorrow, a lot of people will be thinking about Payne as well. I once had a conversation with Charlie Reimer. He said he believed that Payne would have been poking around the old Orlando studios, maybe dipping his toe into television. What do you think Payne Stewart would be doing this very day had he lived to see this day?
If Payne were still alive, he would be winning on the Champions Tour. He would be entertaining at night. He was never shy. He carried that harmonica wherever he went. And whenever we had the chance, I say me, Mark Lai, and Payne, whenever we had a chance to jump up at a pro-am gig and perform and play, we weren't very good, but it didn't matter because that wasn't our day job. But I think Payne would be so immersed in the game of golf. Like I said, he didn't play for money. He played for principle. And I think right now he would be one of the defining voices in the game amongst all this acrimony that we see with the tour and LIV Golf and the public investment fund with the Saudis. I think Payne would be a stabilizing voice. Nobody wanted to have more fun than Payne, but nobody understood the principle of the game and why we're out here doing this.
Now, almost no one's having more air miles this week than Jake. Take us through your travel schedule and why you're going coast to coast.
Well, I'm in Portland right now with family, grandkids. I'm going to the Payne Stewart Award tomorrow morning. I wouldn't miss it. I will never miss it. It's such an important evening. Then I'm turning right around and jumping back on a Delta jet, and I am flying back to Portland to finish the week here. But another exciting event's being held at my home club here in Portland, Oregon. Waverly Country Club is hosting the U.S. Senior Women's Open. So a lot of my friends will be competing this week, and hopefully I'll be out there Saturday, Sunday, watching these great champion women try to win another USGA title.
Sounds like a busy itinerary, but I know that's how you like it, Jake. Safe travels and enjoy tomorrow in Atlanta, and we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you, guys. Good to see you both.
And you too, folks. And don't miss it. The Payne Stewart Award show presented by Southern Company tomorrow night starting at 7 p.m. Eastern Time right here on Golf Channel. And the U.S. Walker Cup team is finally set. And after the break, we'll be joined by the man leading that team, Mike McCoy, to discuss the strengths of his team as they head to St. Andrews in 2 weeks' time. Stay with us. How about the first five players? Nick Dunlap won the USAM. David Forty's a friend of the program. UNC guy. How about Nick Gabrolczyk? He went to North Florida. You got Austin Greaser, another UNC guy. Stuart Hagestad about to play in his fourth Walker Cup.
The old wily veteran.
Yes, he is.
These days. The next five, Ben James, Dylan Minnette, who's been a college stud, the world number one ranked amateur here. Gordon Sargent.
Oh, we know what he can
do off the tee. Preston Summerhays of the Summerhays family that's been in and around the game of golf for generations and generations now. And Caleb Surratt rounds out this 10-man team that we're seeing for the Walker Cup. And they'll be led by this man, Mike McCoy, who's the Walker Cup captain. He was part of that 2015 Walker Cup team, won the 2013 U.S. Mid-Am, got him a spot in the 2014 Masters, has competed in 65 USGA championships. Back in the day, played his college golf at Wichita State University. He was the second oldest champion in the history of the Mid-Am, winning it at 50 years old. Mike McCoy on the show now. Captain, good to see you. When you take a look at your Walker Cup roster on paper, how has this team come together?
Well, it's, you know, it's been 2 years, and the process has been 2 years. And, you know, I'm happy it's finally you know, organized and selected, and now we can really turn our attention to the old course and getting over to Scotland and start preparing for the match on September 2nd. So I'm thrilled with the group, very talented. I think there's a lot of chemistry. These players have known each other since junior golf, so there's you know, there's some natural chemistry just because of the longevity that they've known each other and the way they've played together.
Mike, what do you want these young people to experience under your watch?
Well, I really want them to have a great week. I want this to be one of the best weeks of their life, and you know, something that 25 years from now they can look back on and really cherish that memory. We had the chance to have the four players who were selected early. We went to Castle Pines before the U.S. Amateur, and we actually got to spend about an hour and a half with Jack Nicklaus. And to this day, he spoke fondly of the 1959 and 61 Walker Cup teams he played on. He remembered every one of his teammates. He remembered who his opponents were, how the matches went. You know, it was just etched in his memory. And boy, you know, if 60 years later, these same players are, you know, holding that memory of the Walker Cup in their mind with such fondness, I'll be really happy that I think we'll have done the right job.
What can you draw on from your experience playing in this 8 years ago, back in 2015, that can be helpful with your team now that you're transitioning to a captain role, but guiding these guys into the old course?
Yeah, I think, I think, you know, we're going to prepare them. I was a little surprised, I think, by, you know, there is, you know, there's usually a pretty good sized crowd. It's a little more partisan than maybe they're used to. So we're going to prepare them a little bit for that, and hopefully we can use that to our advantage. And then, you know, obviously the weather can play a big role in Scotland. I think we were lulled to sleep, you know, by the forecast. We had the wind coming one direction, and on the first day of competition, it had done a 180. And, you know, we were at Royal Lytham with, you know, they have hundreds of bunkers. And you know, we were bunkers we didn't think were in play. We're in play. And so we made a lot of mistakes. So I think we're going to be a little more prepared for different shifts in the wind and the weather. And we're going to really, you know, get to know where those bunkers are at St. Andrews.
Mike, something very special is happening over the next couple of months. You're from Iowa, the greatest amateur golfer from Iowa in the history of the state, some might say. You're captaining the Walker Cup. Zach Johnson, the greatest professional, arguably, player from Iowa at all times, captaining the Ryder Cup. How much will you speak Iowa to Iowa, man to man, about what it's like to try to win on the road?
Well, yeah, Zach and I are friends, and I do, you know, I obviously, he's one of the great competitors I've ever seen, and his tenacity over his career is inspirational to so many people. But we have had a chance to talk a few times, and I'm sure he wishes his team was assembled like mine is now, but he's got a few more days to go, and I know he's probably working hard on that. But yeah, it's a great honor for the state of Iowa and Iowa Golf Association. I know everybody in the state's, you know, really proud that we're both getting the opportunity to captain these two important international competitions. I did speak to Zach for about an hour the other night. He was very gracious. Obviously, he knows his way around St. Andrews quite well. He won a British Open there. And he couldn't have been more helpful to me, and gave me a lot of time and walked me around and you know, shared his philosophy about how we need to maybe approach the golf course. And I, you know, I got the same kind of advice from Jack Nicklaus. So, I mean, I feel like we've got a pretty good head start on how we need to evaluate the golf course and get our guys ready. But we're proud of Zach, and, you know, we're all going to be cheering for him while they're in Rome. And I know they're going to be cheering for us at St. Andrews.
Zach, pretty good guy to ask for advice about how you can win at the old course, given he hoisted the Claret Jug there back in 2015, the year that you played the Walker Cup. When an Open is contested at the old course, it just hits differently. It's a celebration of golf. What chord do you think it'll strike for the Walker Cup being contested at the old course?
Well, this is the centenary. It's the 100th anniversary. And so I know the R&A has you know really pulled out all the stops. There's a big contingent of American members of the R&A, and I think, you know, the vast majority of them are coming over. You know, I think, you know, a lot of friends, family, a number of the host clubs that have hosted Walker Cup sites are bringing big contingents. So, you know, I think we're going to have a nice support system there. I think none of the players on my team have really had the chance to play St. Andrews. I don't think they've been even in Scotland. So I'm excited to see the look on their eyes, kind of remembering, you know, the look I had when I first laid eyes on the old course. And I'm going to enjoy I'm going to find a lot of pleasure in seeing, you know, the happiness I hope that comes across their faces when they first lay eyes on it. And you can't help but remember everything that, you know, that happened at St. Andrews, all the important championships, all the great champions that have won there. And you know, they get a chance to make their little bit of history at St. Andrews. So I think it's going to be a pretty special week for them.
Well, hopefully you guys are just as happy at the end of the week. Best of luck at the upcoming Walker Cup.
Well, I appreciate it. I hope we're happy at the end of the week, too. Hey, thanks. I, you know, love tuning into you guys. It's really a great way to spend part of the day.
Much appreciated. Always good to see you, Mike. So still to come on Golf Today, ahead of his new book, Gambler Secrets from a Life at Risk, author and sports gambler Billy Walters sat down with our Jimmy Roberts to discuss his book and his dealings with Phil Mickelson. You don't want to miss this. It's a book that we'd been hearing about for quite some time, the hype leading up to it, maybe a year out, that Billy Walters was going to release this book. What was he going to go into detail with his relationship with Phil Mickelson? The day is tomorrow, but he did have this conversation with Jimmy Roberts, so let's get more into Billy Walters and the backstory. He's arguably one of the most successful sports gamblers of all time, is releasing that new book tomorrow called Gambler, Secrets from a Life at Risk. In this autobiography, Walters talks about his childhood, how he got into sports gambling, his time in prison, also his relationship with Phil Mickelson. Our Jimmy Roberts in the sit-down with Walters to discuss his new book, as well as the man who has perhaps changed the landscape of professional golf forever.
The book is called Gambler, Secrets from a Life at Risk. It's the life story of Billy Walters. Billy, thanks for joining us. There are so many interesting stories in the book, but I want to stick to a few narrow areas of interest, which I know would be of interest to the people who are watching Golf Channel, and I think you probably know where I'm going with this. You have 28 chapters in the book. Mm-hmm. Only two of them are dedicated primarily to Phil Mickelson or mention Phil Mickelson a good deal, and yet that's what's getting the majority of the attention here. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I guess I understand it to a certain degree, and to a certain degree, I really don't understand it. I mean, in order for me to write this book and in order for me to tell the story, it was imperative that that I had to share my relationship with Phil, because another one of my motivations in writing the book, I went to federal prison. I was convicted of insider trading. I was in there 31 months. While I was in prison, unfortunately, my daughter committed suicide. And when that happened, I knew I was going to write this book. And the way I ended up in federal prison, Phil had a lot to do with that, in my opinion. In the insider trading case, I thought Phil and I had become friends through our business relationship. And to be honest with you, that probably hurt me more than anything, because when it came time for him to come forward and do, you know, be a stand-up guy and simply do nothing but tell the truth, he didn't do it. And clearly, I believe, although I didn't testify in my own trial, and that was a big mistake that I made in retrospect, but I believe then and I believe now, if Phil had came forward and done nothing but tell the truth, as he told me he had told the FBI on two previous occasions, I don't think I would have ever gone to prison. I also don't believe if I'd been in prison, I don't think my daughter would have ever committed suicide. So after I was convicted in New York, Jimmy, and I went to federal prison, I never heard from Phil the entire time, even when my daughter committed suicide. After I was convicted in New York, he issued a public statement distancing himself from me. Mm. But I saw him one time, I saw him briefly, he approached me and told me he was glad to see me back playing golf again.
You must have been angry.
Well, sure, Jimmy, I was angry, but I'm still angry.
All right, let me move on to something else which has really gotten the lion's share of the headlines, and that's the phone call that you say that Phil made to you in 2012 from Chicago, from the Ryder Cup, wanting to place a $400,000 bet. Mm-hmm. You can parse the language, but it seems like a denial from Phil. Mm-hmm. Well, he didn't come outright and say that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So basically what we've got here is a he said, she said. So give me your take on this. I mean, does it annoy you when you see that denial from him?
Well, first of all, I don't look at it as a denial. I look at it as the bottom line, he's confirmed it. Because at the end of the day, he called me and wanted to bet $400,000 on the U.S. team to win a Ryder Cup. I was shocked. My response was, have you lost your mind? Don't you know what happened to Pete Rose? I mean, you're looked at as a modern-day Arnold Palmer. You've created this image. You would destroy your entire career. The bet never happened. I never alleged that it happened. He'd never called me. We'd never discussed any kind of golf betting before or after that. There was only one occasion. The statement that he issued that I read, he said he never bet on the Ryder Cup. I never said he bet on the Ryder Cup. But I don't see him denying that he ever tried to bet on the Ryder Cup. Mm-hmm. So to me, I see the statement as a confirmation. I mean, maybe you look at it differently, but I never said he bet on the Ryder Cup. So the statement he issued, I don't see him refuting any part of that. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's talk about gambling in a general sense here, okay?
Sure.
I cannot count how many times in reading the book that I heard you utter the phrase, or I saw the phrase on the page that said, I was broke.
Oh, yeah.
How much money do you think you've lost in your entire life gambling? Any way to put a finger on it?
Oh, I mean, I've lost billions, I'm sure.
Billions with a B?
Well, I'm sure I have because, Jimmy, I mean, I've had $1 billion worth of gross wagers betting sports, and I've been betting sports for a long, long time. But when you say lost, I mean, yeah, I mean, I lost, but I won. Overall, I've won a lot of money gambling, a tremendous amount of money gambling. I've won hundreds of millions of dollars betting sports.
You talk about your process and how critical information is. Hmm. There's a quote from the book that I love. In the book, you say, my primary message is that the average Joe or Jane faces an almost insurmountable set of disadvantages that virtually guarantee a significant loss over the long term unless you can flip the odds in your favor. So if that's the message from a guy who has spent his entire life not only gambling but studying gambling, mm-hmm. why in the world would anybody bet?
Well, you would only bet because it's something fun to do. Everybody wants to, you know, watch whether it be a golf tournament, whether it be a football game or a basketball game. It's fun to have a bet on a game. Bottom line is, you know, set aside whatever amount of money you can afford to bet. You know, you've got to have some discipline about what you're going to do. And I think that's great as long as you pursue it that way. If you decide you're going to get a lot more serious about it, or if you're an average better now and you want to get better, I put charts in this book that explains, okay, every half point what it's worth. So if you decide you're going to buy a half point, what's a fair price to pay? As an example, money lines compared to point spreads. Okay, now you know exactly what a money line is compared to a point spread. The other thing that I hope this does is, for the first time ever, people are betting. They can understand, okay, the fair prices of these things. Maybe it'll put a little bit of pressure on these people that are booking sports, and maybe they'll start giving people, a little bit fairer prices, so to speak. But as far as public awareness is concerned, back to your original question, my advice to anyone betting sports, look, you know, you want to bet a lot of money on sports, okay. It's a lot of fun to do, and it's very exhilarating when you win a big bet. But if you're thinking about doing it for a living, it's a very tough thing to do and win consistently at. I can assure you that.
One last one about Phil.
Yes, sir.
Did you see a little bit of yourself in Phil?
Sure.
Just that simple?
Yeah, just that simple.
Don't care to elaborate?
Look, Phil and I have a lot in common, as I wrote in the book. I mean, there's quite a bit of difference in our ages, but look, you know, he's an action guy. He likes action. Again, the issue I had with Phil was just simply, look, I thought we were friends. And when it came time for him to come forward and help a friend and do nothing but tell the truth, he didn't do it. And that's the issue I've got with Phil. I don't have any other issue with Phil.
The book is called Gambler: Secrets from a Life at Risk. Billy Walters, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's nice to finally meet you.
It's my pleasure.
After an excerpt of Billy Walters' book was released to the public, Phil Mickelson put this statement out on his social media pages on August 10th, saying, quote, "I never bet on the Ryder Cup. While it is well known that I always enjoy a friendly wager on the course, I would never undermine the integrity of the game. I've also been very open about my gambling addiction. I have previously conveyed my remorse, took responsibility, have gotten help, have been fully committed to therapy that has positively impacted me, and I feel good about where I am now," end quote. After this interview with Billy Walters, Golf Channel reached out to Phil Mickelson's team for a response to Billy's claim that he would have avoided prison time if Phil had testified. And we received this statement from one of Phil's PR strategists. A lawyer for Mickelson said any testimony wouldn't have made any difference in whether Walters was convicted. The lawyer noted that Walters didn't testify on his own behalf, and that he was convicted on multiple counts, and none of those pertained to his relationship with Mickelson. And folks, you can watch the entire interview with Billy Walters on our Golf Channel YouTube page. A lot to unpack there, George. What did you take away from that chat with Jimmy?
Yeah, it's interesting to hear Billy Walters say that Phil's tweet wasn't an outright denial in his mind, that Phil didn't explicitly say, "I never had the conversation." Does the conversation then immediately lead to the potential, quote, crime, like in the golf world context, of even wanting to bet on the Ryder Cup, or even entertaining that as a flight of fancy? Phil says that he never bet on the Ryder Cup, but if any other sport, you've seen what's happened in the NFL recently with players betting on NFL games, even if it wasn't their team, and they're suspended for the year, or suspended right for six games or whatnot. I mean, that's a hot button issue. We're talking about the 2012 Ryder Cup, but if there's any credence to that, it should be very concerning. If you had conversations that came out of LeBron James wanting to bet on Lakers games or Tom Brady betting on Patriots games, that would be headline news on any news outlet or any sports outlet yeah going forward. I think golf, it's a little different because it's kind of interwoven to the fabric of the game, where you had golfers who were gambling on the side in the 30s and 40s yeah and 50s to augment their lifestyle and what they were making. It's kind of the romanticized notion of the swashbuckling gambler when it comes to golf. But when the Ryder Cup's involved, that's alarming. So to me, that was the takeaway from the conversation. was that Billy says he didn't refute the fact that, in his mind, that Phil says that they maybe had that phone call. In Billy's mind, they did, and Phil doesn't outwardly say it.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, in this era where gambling and sports, though, the lines are getting blurrier.
Much
and
more normalized.
Blurrier. I mean, it is more normalized now. And it's almost like that situation where the person gets pulled over for drunk driving. The first time this has happened, probably not the first time. Maybe it's the first time you've been caught. Now, I do wonder, is this something that the PGA of America or the PGA Tour decides to really investigate? Are there receipts? I give Phil credit for admitting that he's had a gambling addiction and he's worked on it and gone to therapy. I think that is to be commended. But that does not necessarily mean that I would, like, not look into the situation and just make sure that what he said didn't happen. Because if it did happen, that's a travesty for one of the most popular players in the history of our sport. And even if it didn't happen, I think the last 2 years, seeing Phil Mickelson in this light, first just with Liv and how he decided why he was going to use this leverage, knowing about the history of Saudi Arabia and human rights and actually knowing that and saying, well, I know what they do to homosexuals, like that whole issue. And then we have this from the Billy Walters, an assertion. We don't know if it's factual or not.
For sure.
This is a loss for the game. This was supposed to be an era in Phil Mickelson's life where the sun was shining on him 24 hours a day, where he was going to be a latter-day Arnold Palmer. And I just think the connectivity of ambassadorship, you know, and how generations are connected one to the next. Phil was supposed to be the next man up. I just personally, as someone who's covered him, it's a loss. It's a loss. And listen, you can care that he went to live or not. His position in the game is forever altered. This book, maybe part of it, maybe 1% of it, 5% of it. The live part, maybe part of it as well. Again, I commend him for acknowledging some of the dark moments, and we all have them in our lives. But, man, this should have been gravy for Phil Mickelson in the game of golf. He was the second most popular player on the planet for 25 years, 30 years, and a lot of that is gone.
He's my favorite guy to watch and one of my favorite guys to cover when he was on the PGA Tour. There are two quick takeaways because we're a little time crunched. One, he mentions the gambling addiction.
Yes.
But then you see Liv Golf tweeting out him and Bryson talking gambling
how
terms
about
and
right
how much
on
they're
the
playing
tee.
For. So that's why I'm like, you're kind of talking out of
both sides
of your mouth there.
Yeah.
Two, big picture, there were a lot of things that Phil said that were accurate as far as how things have played out. If you don't look at where the money comes from, the structure of the PGA Tour needing to fundamentally change, there being a need for potential outside capital and a for-profit entity. The concerning part is why did Phil need this money? And now we're learning a lot of it to the extensive gambling losses that pushed him into this direction to then fundamentally alter the golf landscape. So I do think Phil has been spot on with a lot of things in the golf landscape and a very sharp mind. But then you also look when these conversations come out about possibly wanting to bet on the Ryder Cup and monumental gambling losses, and maybe that's why he needed all this upfront money. It's kind of sad in some respects as well.
I watched that man carry a Wanamaker trophy in the gloaming at Kiawah, walking off that 18th green.
Most incredible weeks I've ever
seen. Like, There goes Tony Romo. This guy's going to be a – this guy's going to make do whatever he wants.
Hey, Romo, speaking Phil circuit. Has got the job done.
Well, exactly. No, I mean – I mean, as a broadcaster.
Staff, I know, as a Cowboys.
I mean, you know, ambassador, spokesperson, broadcaster, motivational speaker.
25 Ryder Cup captain.
George Foreman knocking out guys at the age of 45. I mean, call it what you want. You know, Romo, George Foreman – that was the guy. That's what my thought was. Watching, you know, the sun going down, and there he is cradling that Wanamaker like a baby. I'm like, man, this guy can do what he wants. He can write whatever ticket he wants. He can own this game. And you know what? He's earned it with his career. And listen, the man signed autographs till his hand would cramp. I saw that with my own eyes. I saw him be very, very giving of his time with kids. I have a sports writer buddy who had cancer, and Phil had his kids make cards for said friend. I've seen some good sides to this man, but I've also seen this darker side, and that's the side that saddens me because that's the loss for this game. And is there a road back for him? I mean, maybe with this, you know, framework agreement there will be. But what a remarkable left turn for a player who was the latter-day Arnold Palmer, make no question about it.
For sure.
It.
And Phil's I've always had a good rapport with him. He's always been kind
always
to me.
Always a fascinating conversation.
But if you look at since 1996, we'll call it, when Tiger turned pro, who are the guys that have had the biggest impact in professional golf? It was Tiger for 25 years.
Yep.
Phil, now 1B. With everything that's unfolded the last 2 years and reshaping how the game of golf will look going forward. Now, Tiger, part of those conversations as a board member, Phil, big part of the other side as they're trying to come together.
Yeah.
I think the fascination with how things are going to unfold and the complication of Phil's legacy, the story isn't fully written yet.
America loves a comeback.
There are more chapters to go to have going forward. I remember U.S. Open last year at the Country Club. Phil's first major back, it was probably 90% cheers for Phil. So I think the general public, they want to have a reason to root for Phil going forward.
It'll be quite the epilogue to whatever book is ultimately written. All right, folks, Victor Hovland has now put himself in great position to fight for the FedEx Cup. Speaking of left turns, we're making one now. We'll discuss his victory at Olympia Fields with two of the best in the business, Brendan Porath and Shane Ryan, right after the break.
And it's time now to meet the press. So with the Tour Championship in our taking a look at the Tour Championship going forward. All right. And as we welcome in our writers, Brendan Porath and Shane Ryan. Guys, looking at Victor Hovland's performance with that 9-under-61. Brendan, let's start with you. Is that the round of the year?
It's close. I don't know if I'm willing to go that far, given that we saw a 62. As multiple 62, saw 63 on Sunday from Russell Henley. This is not to diminish his back nine, maybe the best back nine of the year. I would just say relative to the field, relative to the conditions, the course, I don't know that I'm willing to call it the round of the year yet, but I think it's indicative of the leap that Victor Hovland has taken this year without winning a major. You know, in golf, we wait these four events, 16 rounds, so much in the course of a year that a talent like Victor Hovland's is probably, it's overanalyzed in how he performs in those events. And of course he didn't win one, but he did have four top 20 finishes, never missed a cut. This is the kind of season that we expect of this talent. And it's been a true leap year for Hovland, whether that was the round of the year or not. It's certainly one of the most memorable moments.
Shane, this guy said my short game sucks just a few years ago. You know, he's winning in Puerto Rico and Mexico and far-flung places. Now he's won at Jack's Place and in the playoffs. I mean, is this, you know, a candidate for one of the two or three best players in the game?
Yeah, I think 100%. And Brendan, come on, man. You're being a little stingy there with your praise. This was absolutely the round of the year. To shoot a 61, to beat Scottie Scheffler. Yeah, it was phenomenal. And I also think it's really good. You know, my brain is always kind of drifting toward the Ryder Cup. I also think it's awesome for Luke Donald to be, you know, to see Victor Hovland playing this well just before it starts. So, yeah, I mean, boy, best two or three, that's tough. But I guess if I just lectured Brendan for being stingy, I'll just say yes. You know, let's let's give Victor his praise. Let's give Victor his praise. That's 61. And, of course, the back nine, just phenomenal.
Shane, when you look at the automatic qualifiers for Team USA, we have six locked in. Three of them are Ryder Cup rookies. As we're looking at this name, the numbers that Scottie Scheffler put up more than doubled who was second, and that would be Wyndham Clark, but it's Brian Harman, Patrick Cantlay, Max Homa, and Xander Schauffele. When you see those six names, what comes to mind, Shane?
You know, the rookie aspect of it is interesting because Max Homa is a rookie, but we saw how well he did in the President's Cup. Someone like Brian Harman, he's a tough guy, you know, and he's never been there because he's never put it together. He's not your prototypical rookie. And then Wyndham Clark has just been, you know, on fire. But also, I would say, look what happened with the rookies in Whistling Straits for the U.S. They were phenomenal. I mean, they put a terrific record together. Being a rookie is not, I think, the scarlet letter that it once was in the Ryder Cup. In fact, at Golf Digest, we just compiled some stats since 1983, which I put as kind of the start of the competitive era of the modern Ryder Cup. U.S. rookies are well over 500. So I, you know, if I'm Zach Johnson, I'm embracing these guys. I think it's great. I'm not scared of the fact that they're rookies even a little bit.
Brendan, earlier today, George and I did our kind of six potential captain's picks. We both put Brooks Koepka on the team. Should we have our heads examined, or are we right to think that without automatic qualifying, Brooks Koepka should still be on that plane to Rome?
Anyone who doesn't put Brooks Koepka on the team should have their heads examined, not you two. He has to be on the team. I know Xander kind of sneaking in that lost auto spot will provide at least a week of conspiracy theory fodder on how he might be done dirty here. But I think it's a moot point. I think this is just a formality. He should be named. His form and his stature in the game, his ability to perform at the most, you know, intense crucibles, right? I know in the past he's had some quotes that sort of made people uneasy about maybe his how much he prioritized the Ryder Cup. But I think we've shown him to be this team player, someone who's kind of embraced a leadership role, I would say, as a dominant American force. And I think that's absolutely, whether it's automatic or as a captain's pick, and he's someone, as we know, on the political side, on the peripheral side, he's not attacked a lot of his would-be teammates or the organizations running this event. He's sort of gone quietly about his business as he went to another tour, and his performance is indicative of someone who has performed in the most intense competitions this year, seems fully healthy and back, and he should absolutely be on the team.
Shane, same side of the Lib Street, looking at Bryson DeChambeau. Do you think he's someone who should be in the conversation for Zach Johnson?
You know, let me bring it back to Brooks just for a second, because I think a really good point Brendan made is he's the most palatable possible Liv player, right? He's pretty well liked. You know, he didn't burn any bridges. He played great. He won a major. And he's somebody that, you know, if you don't take him, it's also going to be this huge story, right? This huge distraction. Zach Johnson's going to have to answer questions. All the players are going to have to answer questions. Why didn't you take Brooks? So for Bryson, I think you flip that around. You know, is he well liked by the players? Who knows? Maybe it's not the same as Brooks, right? Is it going to be a big deal if you don't take him? Probably not, right? It's probably not expected that he's going to be on the team the way it is for Brooks. Did he win a major this year? No, he didn't. So, you know, he's played great golf, and, you know, all respect to Bryson. And I thought he was terrific. You know, he had a tough Ryder Cup in Paris, but he was terrific in Whistling Straits. He had that tremendous moment in singles against Sergio Garcia where he kind of put the hammer down for the U.S. So I don't think it's a bad thing to have a guy like Bryson DeChambeau on the Ryder Cup team, but I don't think he's going to make it this year. I don't think he's necessarily earned it, and I don't think it's going to be that much of a story when he doesn't make it.
Oh, it's a juicy time of year. That's what we love. Brendan, Shane, thanks so much for the time. We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to have Ian Baxter, first tee at Tampa Bay. Good friend of Gary Koch, join us on the show, share more about what the award will mean to his pal, who's the upcoming Payne Stewart Award recipient. That honor will be bestowed on Gary tomorrow. We'll be right back.
Great to have Ian with us. Ian, you've known Gary for a long time. Why is he so deserving of this honor?
Yeah, you know, Gary's really the linchpin of our program, and he has been for 12 to 15 years. You mentioned he's our board chair, but he's so much more than that. You know, he basically built our board years ago to make it one of the most influential nonprofit groups in all of Tampa. But even more than that, he's really hands-on with the kids. He'll come out, especially with the teenage kids, and work with them and get to know them. And, you know, he has a scholarship program, which a lot of kids have been recipients of over the years. So he really does it A to Z. And I would say this, there is no better PGA or LPGA representative that I know in the First Tee Network that does more for his or her chapter than Gary. He just really is everything and really has contributed to our success.
With his footprint with the First Tee of Tampa Bay, I'm going to guess then that's why you think he's so deserving of receiving this honor.
Yeah, I mean, you just look at some of the names that are on that list, past recipients, and it's kind of a who's who in golf. And Gary certainly deserves to be on that list. You know, you guys know Gary. He's not a spotlight guy. He likes to stay behind the scenes and give other people credit and all that. So it's really good to see him, you know, receiving this award, so other people really realizing the things that he's done. You know, I've seen in our group here in Tampa, I've seen all of the works that Gary has done over the years. And so we're all really proud and happy for him that he's finally received this recognition.
How has Gary's foundation with Donna helped kids in terms of scholarships? What have you seen the direct impact on their lives?
Yeah, so many great stories over the years. I think there's 25-plus kids who have received $10,000 or more scholarships each from Gary and Donna's foundation. Again, so many stories. Geraldine, who has gone through a lot of personal hardships and heartaches to continue on and actually is on her way to her nursing degree. We have Sanuda, who recently graduated from Gary's alma mater, University of Florida, with both his undergraduate and master's degree in engineering. And somebody like Evan, who took the pro route tour, he's trying to make it on the Advocates Tour right now, but also got his undergraduate and graduate degree from Florida International University. So, you know, these are just three of many stories of kids who have reached not only through his scholarship program, but also just overall in the program.
You're going to be in the audience tomorrow to see Gary receive his award in Atlanta. Gary's usually a pretty stoic guy. You don't see a ton of emotion out of him. But what do you think that moment is going to mean to Gary?
Yeah, I think he's really proud. You know, when you saw the video, I think you guys presented it when he was presented the award by Mrs. Stewart, and he was just taken aback and really blown away. And again, we're so proud of everything he's done here in Tampa. You know, this award reflects that. But, you know, I know he's really happy and proud to be a recipient of this award because he knows what it means on a national level.
You might see Peter Jacobson as well. He'll be there tomorrow night. Thanks for the time, Ian. Enjoy your time in Atlanta.
Thanks for having me.
There's history on the line this week at the U.S. Senior Women's Open as one of the best players to ever play the game will be rooting for her sister to join her on the champions list. We'll catch up with Charlotta Sorenstam as she tees it up at Waverly Country Club later this week.
Now, Charlotta Sorenstam joining us as she gets ready to make her debut in the U.S. Senior Women's Open, a winner on the LPGA Tour, as well as the 1993 NCAA Women's Individual Champ during her time at the University of Texas. Charlotta, how are you doing?
I'm doing great this morning. How are you guys?
Couldn't be better. As the U.S. Senior Women's Open has evolved, this will be the fifth playing of this championship. What's your perception been as you get ready to make your debut?
Well, leading up to the event, we got a lot of information and text messages, and it's all, you know, now done online compared to before when you came on site. So everything was prepped when we came to the airport to pick up the car, and then this morning driving into the club, everything is set up just like a great USGA event. So really looking forward to playing this week.
Charlotta, some players at this vintage want to kind of put their feet up, maybe teach the kids how to play. I know you work at IMG as well. But what has kind of prompted you to get back inside the ropes and compete?
I've always been loving the competitive part and the practice part. And I've been sidelined a little bit due to some surgeries and some complications from the surgeries. But I feel healthy enough to walk 18 holes, and watching my students play all the time in tournaments, I kind of got the bug again. So when I saw there was a qualifier, I said, okay, I'm going to try while I can, right? Take advantage of an opportunity of trying, and then I did, and so I'm happy to be here.
Your sister won this event a couple years ago. First time we're taking the U.S. Senior Women's Open to the West Coast, to Waverly Country Club in Portland. Can you give us a breakdown of what we're going to see this week at this layout?
Well, just like a lot of the Portland courses or Oregon courses, I mean, we played the regular U.S. Open over at Pumpkin Ridge quite a while ago, and it's got that same feeling with the trees and the grass is all nice and green. So I think hit the fairways and putt well, and that's going to be the winner.
Well, you're the co-medalist in Tampa. How would you describe the state of your game right now?
It's not bad. I've been practicing quite a bit this summer while working as well, but it's not bad. I'm pretty happy where I am. So it's let's see if the nerves can handle this situation, and then if they can, I'll be pretty happy playing.
How important is it to have an event like this to be able to gear your game up for it, and then also to have a stage to be able to celebrate players at this portion of their career?
Oh, it's great. I mean, I'm looking at the driving range right now or meeting my old friends from the tour, and it's just, it's a nice little get together, but it's still at a big stage. And I think it's great to see all the volunteers and all the staff here. It's Monday morning. It's really early, but still a lot of people here with great support. So, we're all very happy for the USGA and all the volunteers this week.
Charlotta, while prepping for this interview, I hopped on your LinkedIn page, and in the bio it said, "I help golfers reach their goals and dreams." How do you do that at IMG?
Sharing my knowledge and passion for the game, I think. I work with a lot of young, inspiring high school golfers, so hopefully get the next level into college and I want to plant some seeds of the love of the game and and also the love of competition. So if they have that as a goal, hopefully I'll be one tool along the way to help them reach them.
Let's look 1 week into the future. It's next Monday. You're looking back at the U.S. Senior Women's Open. What needs to happen for you to say that was a good week?
I would love to finish top 10. I think my game is there, but like I said, I haven't played a lot of competition. So I just need to calm my nerves and just play golf and not worry about what situation or event I'm in, and just enjoying every shot, every moment that I have on the golf course.
Charlotta, you've done a lot just to get back inside the ropes. You mentioned the back surgeries. I count at least three that you had. What kind of maintenance do you have to do to be warm, ready, and competitive this week?
A lot of stretching and combined with strengthening. But, the complications is mostly in my left leg. So it's partially paralyzed, actually. So a lot of walking on the flat surface, I hope, not too hilly here. It just gets tired and tight, so stretching. And I'm lucky I saw the locker room here. We have a lot of trainers and they can help me with that. So I'm looking forward to having a great week.
Always got to listen to your body. It was 25 years ago that you were part of the European Solheim Cup team. Next segment here on Golf Today, we're going to look at the 8 automatic qualifiers for Team Europe. Your memories of that, and not sure if you've had a look at what Team Europe may look like this year.
I have a little bit, and it looks strong. Couple of Swedes there, right? But they've all played great. It great memories of that tournament. Just the environment. I mean, it's growing every year, so you can't compare to when, like you said, 25 years ago. It was big then, and I also helped out at one of the Solheim Cups as a helper for the European team. So it was already. Amazing event back then as well, so I can't imagine what it is this year, a few years later, but the competition is just amazing. I love it.
Lots to look forward to. Solheim Cup, Ryder Cup, U.S. Senior Women's Open as well. Charlotta, thanks for the time. Have a great week out in Portland.
Thank you so much for having me, and it was a pleasure.